Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here's our first story. Additional 45 COVID-19 cases confirmed in Story County. The positivity rate is 4.3%. An additional 45 new COVID-19 cases were confirmed in Story County between Monday and Tuesday. The state's coronavirus website showed at 10 a.m. on Tuesday. No new deaths were reported. At that time, state officials reported 9,430 positive cases in Story County, up from Monday's total of 9,385. The state changed its reporting system to count all positive tests, even those taken by the same individual, showing 10,093 positive tests in Story County at 10 a.m. Tuesday. To date, a total of 45 Story County residents have died as a result of COVID-19, according to Iowa's coronavirus website. Of those who have tested positive for the virus in Story County, 8,829 individuals have recovered. The positivity rate over a 14-day period is 4.3%, up from Monday's total of 3.4%. To date, a total of 136,001 COVID-19 tests have been conducted in Story County. Across the state of Iowa, an additional 621 positive cases were reported, as well as 26 deaths were reported on Tuesday morning. Our next story comes to us from the Des Moines Register. Iowa Senate passes a bill shortening early voting period, as well as creating stricter cutoff for absentee ballots. A bill shortening Iowa's early voting period, reducing Election Day voting by an hour, and creating a stricter deadline for returning absentee ballots is one step closer to becoming law after it passed the Iowa Senate on Tuesday. The Senate's approved the measure on a party line vote of 30-18, with every Republican in support and every Democrat opposed, following a lengthy debate about voter fraud and voter suppression. The legislation would shorten Iowa's early voting period by 9 days, taking it from 29 days to 20 days. It would prevent county auditors from mailing absentee ballot request forms to voters, unless the voter asks for one, and from setting up satellite voting sites unless petitioned. And the bill would create new criminal charges for county auditors who disobey state rules. Republicans amended the legislation Tuesday to move up Iowa's poll close time from 9 p.m. to 8 p.m. for all elections. Currently, the polls close at 9 p.m. for all elections except city and school board elections, which close at 8 p.m. The amendment would also require absentee ballots cast by most voters to be received by the county auditor by the time the polls close on Election Day in order to be counted. Under current law, ballots mailed the day before the election day count as long as they are received by noon on the Monday following elections. Republicans argued the bill, Senate File 413, would create uniform election procedures across Iowa's 99 counties and would strengthen the integrity of elections in the state. Democrats accused Republicans of making it harder to vote and legislating based on debunked conspiracy theories. Senator Jim Carlin, a Republican from Sioux City, who currently announced he is running for the United States Senate, listed several results from the election that he believes show there was fraud. There is no evidence of widespread fraud in the 2020 election, despite claims to the contrary from many prominent Republicans, including former President Donald Trump. Most of us in my caucus and the Republican caucus believe the election was stolen, Carlin said. Senator Joe Bocholm, a Democrat from Iowa City, said Republicans have encouraged people to doubt the results of the election. Give me a break, he said. The reason some people have lost faith or are losing faith in our elections is that Republicans have manufactured, fostered, and encouraged that through silence and conspiracy theories, as well as cult behavior. The Iowa House is expected to approve on Wednesday, which would send that bill to the Republican Governor Kim Vilsack's desk. House lawmakers held a public hearing Monday night where opponents of the legislation outnumbered supporters. Hundreds of people also submitted comments about the legislation online, the vast majority of which or whom were opposed. Several speakers at Monday's hearing focused on the ban on county auditors mailing absentee ballot requests, which was altered in the version of the bill that the Senate passed on Tuesday. They also concentrated on a provision that would ban all but family members, household members, or caregivers to return someone's ballot for them. Adams County Auditor Becky Bissell, a Republican, described two elderly voters in her county. One calls her office to ask for an absentee ballot request form. Another relies on church members to help her through the voting process and return her ballot. Smaller, rural communities have a large elderly population who typically choose to vote absentee because of weather or health concerns. Why are we making it harder for them to vote? She said. Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill, a Democrat who Trump's campaign sued last year for sending pre-filled absentee ballot request forms to registered voters, said the bill's criminal penalties for county auditors and increased powers for the Secretary of State will worsen the fractured partnership among the state's election officials. The legislation will pit county auditors against the Secretary of State by placing the Secretary in a position of being the judge and the jury over county auditors, and put auditors in the predicament where the choice is not to report an error that is discovered in their office, or to report the error and risk being accused of committing a felony, Gill said. Emily Russell, a supporter of the legislation, argued that county officials need to be stopped from ignoring election laws. I've seen a lot of people throw around the words voter suppression when none of those provisions are an obstacle to someone who wants to vote. And similar provisions exist in other states, Russell said. Some supporters also shared unfounded conspiracy theories about election fraud. Others who said the bill would provide uniformity in the way Iowa's elections are conducted. Iowans in Denison should know that elections that are happening in Iowa City are happening in exactly the same way as they are in their town, and vice versa. That according to Andy Conlin, a lobbyist with the Opportunity Solutions Project, a group that advocates for individual liberties and a limited government. Brian Jack Holder, a libertarian who has run for Congress four times in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, said the bill would make it harder for libertarians and independents to nominate candidates and place their names on the ballot. We the people no longer have representative government nor free and fair elections. When independent and third-party candidates are punished with undue burdens and arbitrary and capricious standards to secure ballot access, he said. Our next story also comes to us from the Des Moines Register. How proposed Iowa legislation would change unemployment in the state and what that means for workers who lose their jobs. Unemployed Iowans would receive less money from the Iowa Workforce Development if a bill working its way through the legislature is approved and signed into law by Governor Reynolds. The Iowa House Labor Committee approved House Study Bill 203 early on Tuesday. The debate was contentious and lasted more than 5 hours. If you think this was a fight, wait until it gets on the floor, said Representative Bruce Hunter, a Democrat from Des Moines, the party's ranking member on that committee. The legislation is eligible for a vote on the House floor. If signed into law, the legislation would take effect in July of 2022. Currently, Iowa Workforce Development determines weekly unemployment insurance benefits based on a number of factors. Any worker with four or more dependents can receive benefits of up to 65% of the state's average weekly wage, or about $475 each week, under the current U.S. Department of Labor calculations. However, House Study Bill 203 would change the formula, requiring Iowa Workforce Development to treat every claimant with one or more dependents the same. Benefits would be capped at 57% of the state's average weekly wage, about $417 a week. Additionally, the legislation would first require claimants to wait a week before receiving unemployment insurance. Second, to require claimants to accept lower-paying jobs than those they formerly held. And third, cut a provision that allows claimants to receive standard unemployment insurance for 39 weeks if their place of employment closes. That would be capped at 26 weeks. The legislation also would change what the state considers suitable work. Out-of-work Iowans who receive unemployment must apply for jobs. They cannot continue to receive benefits if they turn down suitable jobs based on how much employers are offering. Under the measure, claimants would have to accept any job that pays at least 80% of their previous wages in their first 4 weeks on unemployment. At any point after 8 weeks, they would have to accept a job paying at least 60% of their previous wages. Currently, the first 5 weeks workers are on unemployment, they can turn down any job that does not pay at least as much as their old job did. But their 18th week of unemployment, they must accept any job that pays at least 70% of what they previously earned. Committee Chairperson Representative Dave Dio, a Republican from Nevada, said he supports the legislation to decrease the amount of money drained from the state's unemployment trust fund. Companies' employment tax rate increases or decreases each year based in part on the size of the fund. Iowa businesses currently pay the second lowest possible rate after a year of record unemployment. The trust fund sat at $940 million as of the beginning of February, down from $1.2 billion the same time last year. It's time to look at the long-term future to ensure the long-term solvency of the unemployment trust fund, Dio said. Lobbying groups that represent employers, such as the Iowa Association of Business and Industry and the National Federation of Independent Businesses, have registered in favor of the bill. Democrats argue the state should not curb unemployment benefits during the COVID-19 pandemic. Hunter said lawmakers should wait a year to see how many workers are still unemployed. During the hearing, Democrats introduced more than 10 amendments, all of which failed. Some proposals would have cut elements of the legislation, while others would have added exemptions for workers in healthcare, meatpacking, law enforcement, and education. Some religious organizations, including the Iowa Catholic Conference and the Iowa Conference of the United Methodist Church, registered against the bill. So did the Iowa Federation of Labor and the Iowa State Education Association. Patrick Wells, who is president of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Iowa State Conference, was the only lobbyist to file a written statement about the bill during a subcommittee meeting held on February 17th. Our next story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. An autopsy shows Iowa State University student died of hypothermia and acute alcohol intoxication. An autopsy shows an Iowa State University student found unresponsive last month in freezing temperatures died of hypothermia and acute alcohol intoxication, according to Ames police in a Wednesday morning release. Olivia Church, who was 21 years of age, was found in the parking lot of Delta 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 Sorority at 302 Ash Avenue. Olivia Cuttich was found unconscious in the sorority parking lot at 9:49 in the morning on January 22nd and later pronounced dead. Police at the time said she was last seen the night before. They believe she had been lying in the parking lot for several hours before she was found. Cuttich was the daughter of Elina Heath, Chief Executive Officer Dr. Penny Wheeler, and Minnesota State Supreme Court Justice Margaret Cuttich. Born in Guatemala and adopted as an infant, Cuttich's mothers wrote in their obituary, "We were not perfect parents and she was not a perfect child, but we were a perfect match." "Olivia was the light of our lives," the parents said in a statement. A junior in communication studies, Cuttich died 3 days before spring semester started. Her sorority chapter members are heartbroken, a post on the Iowa State University Tri-Delta Instagram page said. Academic advisor Sabrina Shields Cook said Cuttich always had a smile on her face and an anecdote to share in class. Iowa State spokesperson Angie Hunt shared a statement from the university on January 22nd, which read, "The Iowa State community is saddened to learn of the death of one of our students. Our thoughts are with her family and her friends during this difficult time." Philip Sitter writes our next story, COVID-19 quarantines and positive cases reported by Story County Schools. Story County School District's online portals show the number of students and staff who are currently in quarantine or have tested positive for COVID-19. The following school districts have provided an update across their student and staff populations. As of Tuesday morning, Story County's 14-day average positivity rate was 4.3%. In the Ames School District, Ames K through 5 schools have conducted 100% in-person instruction this year. The high school and the middle school began 100% in-person instruction February 1st. Students continue to have a remote campus option. The district reported the following statistics on Tuesday. The Ames preschool and elementary schools: confirmed COVID-19 positive cases, students less than 6, remote 0, staff less than 6. Quarantined as close contacts, students 6, staff less than 6. Student 5-day absent rate 0.9%, staff 5-day absent rate 2.8%. Ames Middle School: confirmed COVID-19 positives, students 0, remote 0, staff less than 6. Quarantined as close contacts, students less than 6, staff 0, student 5-day absent rate 0.8%, staff 5-day absence rate 3.6%. Ames High School: confirmed COVID-19 positive cases, students 0, remote 0, staff 0. Quarantined as close contacts, students less than 6, staff 0. Present 5-day absence rate for students 1.3%, staff 5-day absence rate 1.8%. All school indicators for students and staff were at the green level. The Ballard School District last updated its COVID-19 tracker February 20th. At that time, 7 students and less than 6 staff members at the Ballard School District had tested positive for COVID-19. According to the update, a total of 76 students and less than 6 staff members were in quarantine as a result of coming into contact with an individual who tested positive for the virus. Last week was the second of 2 weeks that the district's high school freshmen were to be in a hybrid learning model because of an outbreak within the class. All other grades were continuing to meet in person, meanwhile, with the remote learning option also continuing. The district's 5-day absence rate for illness is 2.6%. In the Gilbert School District, as of February 26, they reported 2 students and no employees having an active COVID-19 case. A total of 4 students and 0 staff members were in quarantine due to exposure to the virus. Additionally, the district reported information pertaining to absentee rates among students and staff. At the district level, 2.7% is the absence rate. At the high school, the absence rate is 2.6%. At the middle school, 1.4%. The intermediate level, 2.8%. And the elementary level, 3.1%. In the Nevada School District on February 21st, the district was informed that a middle school student had tested positive for COVID-19. 29 students were identified as close contacts, and 5 students were asked to quarantine because of an unmasked exposure. As of February 18th, this Nevada School District was reporting the following statistics. At Central Elementary, absence rate due to COVID-19, 0. Absence rate due to quarantine, 0.18%. At the Nevada Middle School, absence rate due to COVID-19, 0. Absence rate due to quarantine, 1.1%. At the Nevada High School, absentee rate due to COVID-19, 0. Absence rate due to quarantine, 1.6%. The district had an overall absence rate of 1.3%. Roland Story schools are operating fully in person with a remote option for families. 1 student and no staff members were currently quarantining due to testing positive for COVID-19 as of Tuesday, according to the Roland Story District's website. Since August 24th, the first day of school, 87 students and 22 staff members have tested positive for the virus. Colonesco and Collins Maxwell school districts do not have online COVID-19 case dashboards on their websites. Our next story comes to us from Daniel Gare. The Butterfly Garden, an aromatic garden, and more. Mary Greeley designs a healing space for patients, staff, and community. Mary Greeley radiation oncologist Dr. Shane Hopkins looked out to a fresh lawn adjacent to the cancer center, imagining how a garden could serve his patients in the cancer ward, a vision that could come to life this year. Mary Greeley Medical Center is $150,000 away from its fundraising goal to create a healing garden that incorporates a butterfly garden, aromatic flowers, and more to lower patient stress. The garden, located between the ambulance bay and the McFarland Clinic, will be next to the William R. Bliss Cancer Center, keeping in mind how the garden can benefit cancer patients. There is science that shows that pet therapy, music therapy, a variety of complementary therapies will help patients who have heart, cancer, or other chronic health conditions, Hopkins said. They're not typically paid for by insurance, and so it's not something that's always on our radar as a way to assist our patients. But there are things that have been shown scientifically to have a positive impact on the health of patients. This is another example of that. Mary Greeley received artist renderings from Shive Hattery Architecture, which shows a winding path and benches surrounded by flowers and green space. In his 10 years at Mary Greeley, Hopkins has seen firsthand the tiring experience cancer patients face each time they travel to the hospital. They grow through their therapy, and oftentimes they know they will be reliving the cycle the next day. These stress levels have only worsened with the pandemic, adding to everyday anxieties. The hormone levels associated with stress in cancer patients are always a thing, Hopkins said, but it's particularly a thing in the middle of a worldwide pandemic, combined with other social issues that have just created a feeling where everyone is at their wits' end and feeling uneasy. Hopkins said the garden would be another escape for patients from the hospital environment. The hospital is not the most homely environment. Although we try to be accommodating and we make it as comfortable as possible for our patients, it still has that clinical feeling to it, Hopkins said. I think a garden is the antithesis to that detachment that we think of in medicine. After a year of stress and exhaustion for medical professionals battling COVID-19, the executive director of the hospital's foundation, Melissa McGarry, said the garden will serve as a space of relaxation for the staff as well as the entire community. This is an opportunity to have a place that hopefully people can sit down and not be distracted with the hustle and the bustle, with bad news from doctors, with demands on their time from work, Hopkins said. They can just take a moment and be with nature and have a little bit of healing. Mary Greeley fundraised more than half the necessary funds, $200,000 of the $350,000 so far, and staff aims to start constructing this spring, McGarry said. Donations can be made at mgmc.org/foundation/healing-garden. Our hope is that this will provide a calming respite for our patients, their families, and the staff, McGarry said. When it's completely funded by our community, that also speaks volumes. Our next story comes to us from Philip Sitter. Black Lives Matter Week is the subject of a hearing. An Iowa House of Representatives committee wants to hear from the Ames Community School District officials how classroom materials were prepared for the district's recent Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action. The week of February 1st, the district kicked off Black History Month with the Week of Action. Teachers engaged students that week with a set of 13 guiding principles through free resources developed by other organizations through the week's activities. They were not formally affiliated with any official Black Lives Matter organization, according to the district. The goals of the week were to affirm students' diverse Black identities, offer them a sense of belonging that they might not otherwise have been feeling, and expand the students' perspectives on Black history and life. The district's efforts were met with a lot of support and criticism from community members and beyond, even attracting the attention of national conservative commentators, including the Federalist. The week also got the attention of some Iowa lawmakers. The Government Oversight Committee's chairperson, Representative Holly Brink, a Republican from Oskaloosa, wrote in a recent newsletter that she had invited Ames district officials to speak at a hearing originally scheduled for Tuesday morning. Ames Superintendent Jenny Reisner told the district school board Monday night, however, that the district had requested the hearing be rescheduled so that we could have some additional time to prepare and answer the questions the committee might have. Brink wrote in her newsletter, local parents, students, and residents contacted Republican legislators regarding their fear that any publicly expressed questions or concerns to the curriculum of the Black Lives Matter at School Week would result in child targeting and charges of racism. Highlighting some of the Black Lives Matter at School Week's 13 guiding principles that have been controversial for some people, principles that affirm queer and transgender students or pushed against the boundaries of what's considered a traditional family, Brink added. Myself and other members of the committee will be very interested to hear from the Ames teachers on how this curriculum was chosen to teach their students, including elementary school students. Reisner said the rescheduled hearing would be in March, but no date had yet been set. She also said the district would continue to be represented as originally scheduled by herself, Director of Equity Anthony Jones, School Board Member Monica Benekin, who leads the board's Equity Committee, and Executive Director of Education Jeff Hawkins. Brink is not the only Iowa lawmaker to comment on the district's Black Lives Matter at School Week. Representative Dan Fisher, a Republican from Montour, wrote on Facebook last week that Black Lives Matter curriculum is a troubling national trend that came to Iowa with the Ames District Week of Action. Fisher wrote, quote, the curriculum is problematic in many ways, serving not as a historical lesson, but as a socio-political indoctrination, unquote. He dismissed the trans and queer affirming principles as Democratic Party ideologies that have nothing to do with Black History Month and are not appropriate for our public schools. The Ames District published a video Friday on its YouTube channel that further explained the 13 guiding principles of the Black Lives Matter at School Week. In the video, featuring Jones and other staff members, Jones said, "The queer affirming principle means that we free ourselves from thinking and believing that everyone in the world is heterosexual, and we are intentional in acknowledging and supporting our queer folks in our policies, our practices, and in our instructional materials." Equity coordinator Jessica Seidler said in the video, "The trans affirming principle means that we as a society need to value the humanity and dignity of people who identify as part of the trans community. Those of us that do not identify as transgender really need to uplift the voices of those who do identify with the trans community so the change can be made with them instead of for them." Seidler added on challenging nuclear family structures in the Black Villages guiding principle. "While it is true that a lot of families are made up of a mom, a dad, a brother, and a sister, that is not true for every family. It could be foster families, it could be adoption, it could be grandmothers or grandfathers, aunties and uncles, cousins. Really, what makes a family is a group of people that come together and love one another and take care of one another. And those families are legitimate and are valuable and they are beautiful." While not directly related to the Ames District's work, some Iowa lawmakers have also pushed back against the use of the 1619 Project or any similarly developed curriculum in schools, U.S. history classes. The project published in 2019 aims to reframe the way slavery and the contributions of Black Americans are presented. Our next story comes to us from Sarah Jordan Hines. Time to Roll opens in Ames. Twin brothers Payne and Peyton Roberts, who are 21 years of age, have launched a new dining experience at the North Graham Mall. It is called Time to Roll, a concept that pairs Tex-Mex with sweet swirls, hard-rolled ice cream. Their entrepreneurial spirit was inspired after a vacation to Hawaii. I had seen rolled ice cream there, Peyton said. I thought it was awesome, and I wanted to bring it to Iowa. I was still in high school at the time, so I did not do much with the idea. But a few months later, Sweet Swirls rolled ice cream opened in Ankeny, and it did very well. Last summer, Peyton operated a Sweet Swirls rolled ice cream food trailer behind the Perfect Games in Ames. When the opportunity came about to secure a storefront location at the mall, a former Mexican restaurant, the brothers jumped at the chance. The duo, originally from Pleasant Hill, Iowa, both have sales and managerial experience. Peyton is currently a student at the University of Iowa studying enterprise leadership. Payne quit his job last fall and threw himself into developing the menu. "It's pretty fun working with my brother," he said. The Tex-Mex Eats will include these items in the coming weeks: egg rolls, corn bites, quesadillas, nachos, taco salads, soft burrito rolls, soft tacos, taco crunches, and burrito crunch rolls. They will all be offered. People can sample these products now. The ice cream portion of the menu is available now. It's all about the experience, watching it being made. It's a unique food, and it's different, and it is paired with our burrito crunch rolls. It is a rolled foods theme, Peyton said. The veggie and seed soft burrito rolls contain rice, beans, lettuce, cheese, and salsa, topped with sunflower seeds and served on a whole wheat tortilla. Crunch rolls are hard-rolled tortillas filled with seasoned meat, and then they are fried. The brothers said the crunch roll idea was inspired by school cafeteria chili crispitos, but they're better. Sweet Swirls rolled ice cream is part of a franchise, and the brothers secured the rights to sell it at their store. "You're able to get fresh-made, handcrafted ice cream and add ingredients," Peyton said. "It's made from our homemade cream." Rolled ice cream, also known as stir-fried ice cream, originated in Thailand and gained popularity in other Southeast Asian countries, including Malaysia, Cambodia, and the Philippines. It's crafted using a milk-based liquid poured into an extremely cold surface, negative 20 degrees. It's spread out, cut using a spatula, and then quickly scraped into a tube-like shape. Their ice cream flavors include vanilla, chocolate, peanut butter, hot cocoa, coffee, and non-dairy. Available in small and regular size bowls and as a shake. Fan favorites include Peanut Butter Party, Very Berry, Cookie Monster, Fluffy Unicorn, S'mores, and Morning Delight Mix-Ins. They encompass fruit, candy, pretzels, cereal, and more, with sauces including strawberry, raspberry, marshmallow, peanut butter, butterscotch, caramel, chocolate, and white chocolate. Specialty cakes and tubs of ice cream are coming soon. Soft drinks are offered, and craft beer and margaritas will be added later. The pair will be offering nightly specials and old local favorites. They hope to see the business grow and one day take their cuisine to the Iowa State Fair. "We hope to bring back some things that used to be really popular in the area that you can no longer get. We hope to grow to a point where we can become the place where people go for family night," Peyton said. "We're going to start out small and hopefully open more locations in stages and progress as we go." Gluten-free options are coming soon, as well as delivery. A dining area allows you to spend some time in the space or take the treats to go. Time to Roll is located at 2801 Grand Avenue. It is open daily from 11 o'clock in the morning to 9 p.m. You can call them at 515-686-7377. And timetorollaims@gmail.com is their address, their web address. That's timetorollaims@gmail.com. Their parent company, Ames Cool Treats, owns the food trailer and the storefront. The food trailer will reopen in summertime. You can visit them on social media. Their webpage is www.facebook.com/timetorollaims. So timetorollaims@gmail.com is their email address. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Barbara Jean Klatt, age 81, of Colo, succumbed to cancer at her home on February 22nd. She was born in Nevada at the sanitarium on May 20th, 1939, to Forrest Edward and Esther Bernice Burley Grooms. Barbara married Ronald Hale Klatt on May 12, 1956, and to this union, four children were born. In 1996, great-grandson Jaeger, Barbara, and in 1996, great-grandson Jaeger was born. Perhaps that's Jagger, J-A-G-G-E-R. Barbara was a homemaker, a child caregiver, and cleaned houses for her professors. She worked at the Iowa State Center in Ames for 20 years. Barbara loved to crochet, to bake, and cook, in which she loved to share with many. She loved hosting big family dinners. Barbara loved camping and traveling around to attend bluegrass festivals. In 1998, she took on the loving task of raising her great-grandson, I don't know if that's Jaeger or Jaeger, Nicholas Roberts. It's spelled J-A-G-G-E-R. Barbara is survived by her husband, Ronald, four children, Marcella, Roberts, and Gail, Michael and Linda, Ronald, Jean, and Sherry, and Kathy. 7-plus grandchildren, 11-plus great-grandchildren, and 1 great-great-granddaughter. Her sisters, Betty, Joan, and Jean Colhone of Nevada, and Karen Erickson of Nevada. Her sister-in-law, Linda Grooms, and Nick of Kansas. Her brother-in-law, Harvey James Worth of Story City, and many nieces and nephews. She is also survived by 2 loving puppies, Coco and Sunday. Barbara was preceded in death by her parents, her sisters, Donna Lee and James, and Alice Worth, her brother, Richard Grooms, and a daughter-in-law, Patricia Klatt. Barbara had a special friend, Myrna Johnson, who was an incredibly good and dear friend, and who was always there to lend an ear. Barbara has requested cremation. There will be a service at a later date, with the date to be announced. A special thank you to Reverend Harding for giving Barbara peace. Memorial contributions may be made to the Colo United Methodist Church, Mary Greeley Hospice, or to the family. Rasmus and Ryan Funeral Home in Nevada is handling arrangements. Condolences may be sent to the family at rasmussenfh.com. Our next obituary, Michaela Sherman, age 24, of Austin, Minnesota, formerly of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died tragically on Saturday, February 20th, following an accident while she was doing what she loved, helping others. A vigil service will be held at 3:30 p.m. on Friday, February 26th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids, followed by a visitation from 4 to 8 p.m. A private funeral service will be held. Burial will take place at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Michaela under Photos and Videos or Media, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, February 27th. Survivors include her father, John, and Mindy Sherman of Marengo, Iowa, her mother, Lisa Sherman of Cedar Rapids, siblings, Dallas and Derek Sherman of Marengo, paternal grandparents, Vernon Happ and Marjorie Sherman of Marengo, maternal grandmother, Peggy Pugmire of Cedar Rapids, uncles, Dan and Sue Sherman, David and Sheila Sherman, and Dale and Deb Sherman, several cousins, extended family members, and her many supportive friends who were like family to Michaela. She was preceded in death by her great-grandmother, Dorothy Walters. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family, which will be used for a memorial fund in her name at Iowa State University. Please share a memory of Michaela at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Our next story, returning to the news, comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Tehran, Iran. Iran officially started restricting international inspections of its nuclear facilities Tuesday in a bid to pressure European countries and U.S. President Joe Biden's administration to lift crippling economic sanctions and restore the 2015 nuclear deal. World powers slammed the restrictions as a dangerous move. It came as the International Atomic Energy Agency reported in a confidential document distributed to member countries and seen by the Associated Press that Iran had added 38 pounds of uranium enriched to 20% to its stockpile as of February 16th. It was the first official confirmation of plans Iran announced in January to enrich to the greater purity, which is just a technical step away from weapons-grade levels and far past the 3.6% purity allowed under the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. It also increased its stockpile of low-enriched uranium to 6,542 pounds, up from 5,300 pounds, reported on November 2nd, according to the IAEA reported. Iran's violations of the JCPOA and the move Tuesday to limit international inspections underscored the daunting task facing President Biden as he seeks to reverse former President Donald Trump's decision to unilaterally pull the United States out of the deal in 2018. Next, we have today's Nation and World Watch. The first item comes to us from Washington, D.C. A federal judge has ordered the wife of Mexican drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman to remain temporarily jailed after she was arrested and accused of helping her husband run his multi-billion dollar cartel and plotting his audacious escape from a Mexican prison in 2015. Jeffrey Lichtman, the attorney for Emma Coronel Aspiro, said he would consent to her temporary detention after her arrest in Dulles International Airport in Virginia. Prosecutor Anthony Nardozzi argued that Coronel should remain jailed. Next in the series from Atlanta, Georgia, former Georgia Senator David Perdue said Tuesday that he will not run in 2022 to reclaim a seat in the United States Senate, 8 days after he filed campaign paperwork that could have opened the way for him to run against Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. I am confident that whoever wins the Republican primary next year will defeat the Democratic candidate in the general election for this seat, and I will do everything I can to make that happen, said Perdue, who is 71, who lost his reelection bid against Democrat John Ossoff. Next, from Pierce, South Dakota, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem on Tuesday called on the state's attorney general to resign as he faces misdemeanor charges for striking and killing a man with his car. Jason Ravensburg, the state's top law enforcement officer, has indicated he will not step down while he waits for the case against him to proceed. Prosecutors have charged him with 3 misdemeanors in the September death of Joseph Bovaer, who was 55 years of age. Republican legislators are also weighing whether to impeach Ravensburg if he does not step down. And from Des Moines, Iowa, a group of 24 scientists, economists, researchers, and other winners of the World Food Prize sent a letter Tuesday to President Biden asking him to focus on alleviating global hunger, poverty, and malnutrition. American leadership will be a beacon that helps to light the way and a catalyst for action that gets us to a world in 2030 where we live within our planetary boundaries. Everyone is well nourished and no one goes to bed hungry. That according to Lawrence Haddad, 2018 World Food Prize laureate. Next, we have some state news briefs. The first item comes to us from Des Moines. A man charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and other counts in a 2019 Des Moines shooting that killed one man and injured another has taken a plea deal, according to Iowa prosecutors. Michael Leike Jr. pled guilty to voluntary manslaughter, willful injury, and intimidation with a dangerous weapon in the June 2019 killing of 41-year-old Earl Caldwell, television station WHO reported on Tuesday. Another man, Littleton William Clark, age 39, of Des Moines, was injured in that incident. Leike had been scheduled to go to trial in April on the more serious charges and would have received a mandatory life sentence if convicted. He now faces up to 30 years in prison when he is sentenced on March 10th. Next, from Ottumwa, authorities have identified a man who was shot to death last week after breaking into a rural home near Ottumwa. Aaron Thompson, age 28, of Brookfield, Wisconsin, was shot by a homeowner after he broke into the home Thursday night, and he fought with the homeowner, the Ottumwa Courier reported. Thompson was flown by helicopter to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, where he died. The Wapello County Sheriff's Office said Thompson appeared to have been suffering from a mental health crisis at the time that he broke into the home, noting that witnesses reported Thompson acting erratically earlier in the day and yelling unintelligibly after crashing his car near the home. Officials said no criminal charges would be filed against the homeowner. The lack of criminal charges do not take away the fact that this was the most unfortunate event possible. That according to Sheriff Don Phillips. Mr. Aaron Thompson, he said, was clearly a successful young man with a bright future. Unfortunately, mental health can affect anyone and appears to have played a significant role in this chain of events. Next, from Armstrong, Iowa, an Iowa mayor who is among a slew of town officials charged with a string of felonies and misdemeanors in a city embezzlement case has resigned his post. Armstrong Mayor Greg Bum, age 69, submitted his written resignation Monday night at a city council meeting, according to the Des Moines Register. The Iowa Attorney General's office has charged Bum, the town's police chief, its city clerk, and two former clerks in an alleged plot to loot the city's coffers. Bum also is charged with misusing a saw from the town's volunteer fire department to benefit his private carpentry business. He and the others, which include Police Chief Craig Merrill, City Clerk Tracy Lang, and former city clerks Connie Thackeray and Mary Statton, were arrested earlier this month. Bum is free on a $67,000 bond. Next, from Iowa City, an Iowa City man has been charged in the shooting death of a man who police said was killed during a robbery. Sammy L. Harmed, age, excuse me, Sammy L. Hamed, H-A-M-E-D, age 22, was charged Monday with first-degree murder in the February 12th death of Quincy Rossum, age 19, at an Iowa City apartment. Officers went to the apartment after receiving a report that someone had been killed during a robbery that involved several people, police said in a complaint. Evidence indicated the shooting occurred 30 minutes before the 911 call. When Harmed was stopped several hours later, he had Russum's cell phone and other items with him, police said. He also had a weapon that matched shell casings found at the scene of the killing, according to the complaint. He has been in custody since February 13th. Authorities continue to investigate that shooting. And from Dow City, Iowa, Authorities have charged a Crawford County woman with murder in the Sunday night shooting death of her boyfriend. The Crawford County Sheriff's Office said deputies were called about 9:15 to a home in Dow City. That's 9:15 p.m. to a home in Dow City to check on a resident. When they arrived, they found Jeremy Frank, age 46, unresponsive and bleeding. Frank was taken to a hospital in Denison, where he was pronounced dead from a single gunshot wound, according to the sheriff's office. Investigators charged Beth Guzman, age 44, of Dow City, with first-degree murder. She was identified as Frank's live-in girlfriend. From Cedar Rapids, Cedar Rapids police on Monday identified a woman who was stabbed to death Saturday as a Cedar Rapids resident. Police identified the woman as Katrina LaFreeze Brinson, age 34. She and another woman were stabbed early Saturday at a Rodaway Inn in Cedar Rapids. Police were called to the motel to check on a disturbance and were directed by the woman to a man running from the building. An officer chased the man and shot him. The man, who has not been identified, remained in a hospital Monday in critical condition. The officer who shot him will be identified later. The second woman who was stabbed was treated at a hospital and was released. Police said there is no known link between the man and the female victims. Our next story comes to us from Philip Sitter at Iowa State University. 39 new cases reported last week. An additional 39 COVID-19 cases were reported at the Iowa State University between February 15 and February 21, according to the university's public health dashboard. This total includes 27 students and 6 staff members identified through on-campus testing, as well as 6 students who were reported testing positive from off-campus sources. The Iowa State spring semester officially began January 25th. The weekly positivity rate is 3.3%, up from 2.1% last week. According to Iowa State's report, from February 8 to February 21, a total of 117 individuals were in quarantine after coming into close contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. Of those in quarantine, 14 people, or 11%, later tested positive, the university reported. From February 15th to the 21st, a total of 46 individuals were in isolation with active COVID-19 cases. As of February 21, 11 on-campus isolation or quarantine rooms were in use, 6 isolation rooms representing 3.8% of capacity, and 5 quarantine rooms representing 2% of capacity. Since January 1st, a total of 227 members of the Iowa State community, including students, graduate assistants, staff, faculty, have tested positive for the virus through on-campus testing. That breakdown is 171 students, graduate assistants 16, staff 33, faculty 7. The Iowa State COVID-19 website was updated February 1st to start tracking data for spring semester. Data from the fall semester and winter break is archived and publicly accessible. Our next story comes to us from London, England. Holiday plans reflect hopes in the United Kingdom. Stir-crazy Britons rushed to book overseas vacations after Prime Minister Boris Johnson unveiled plans to slowly ease a national lockdown, boosting optimism that travel restrictions will be removed in time for the summer holiday season. TUI, the United Kingdom's largest tour operator, said bookings increased sixfold on Monday, the company's busiest day in more than a month. Discount airline EasyJet said demand for flights more than tripled, and package holiday company Thomas Cook said traffic on its website increased 75%. International travel has nearly ground to a halt globally, so the increases are a sign of hope for the beleaguered industry. We have consistently seen that there is pent-up demand for travel, and this surge in booking shows that this signal from the government that it plans to reopen travel has been what UK consumers have been wanting or waiting for. That according to EasyJet Chief Executive Officer Johan Lundgren. While the plans were welcomed by travel companies, many business leaders were disappointed at the slow pace of reopening, as some restrictions are expected to remain in place until June 21st. Others criticized the government for failing to guarantee current levels of support for business hurt by the COVID-19 pandemic. The Office for National Statistics said Tuesday that the United Kingdom's unemployment rate rose to 5% in December, up from 0.1% the previous month and 1.3% from a year earlier. The number of people on company payrolls has dropped by 726,000 since the pandemic began last February. Here's the Dennis the Menace comic for today. Dennis has gotten a goldfish from the pet store, I guess, and he's putting the goldfish into a fishbowl at home. His friends, Tommy and a female friend, I'm not sure who she is, are watching. Everybody is smiling. They're happy, happy, happy. And Dennis says to the goldfish, "Don't worry, if you get tired of swimming in circles, Mom says I can set you free down the toilet." And here's the real life comic for today. A man is sitting in his lazy boy chair at home. A woman with her jacket on and a purse is standing in front of him. And she says, "I'm going to the store. Is there anything that you're out of?" And he says, "Yeah, luck, patience, and options." And the wife says, "Alrighty then." And I'm afraid that's all we have time for with the Ames Tribune today. Your reader today has been Dave Sowerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.